You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Colombia produces about 90% of the cocaine sold in the United States, and in the last 8 years, the U.S. has spent more than $6 billion trying to stop that. Gary Leach, an independent journalist and the editor of Columbia Journal, has been reporting on the complexities of the country's drug wars, and now he's written a book about his experiences called Beyond Bogota, Diary of a Drug War Journalist in Colombia. It's published by Beacon Press. I'm very pleased that it brings Mr. Leach to the show today. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me, Leonard.
Now, you've traveled and worked throughout Latin America. What sets Colombia apart?
Well, I first visited Colombia in 1989, and the interesting thing was it was the one country everyone told me not to visit. It's too dangerous. You're going to get kidnapped. You're going to get robbed. Or you're going to get killed.
No matter where you go, or just Medellin, which is what I was warned about.
Yeah, no, they were just saying pretty much anywhere, traveling in Colombia back then. And so, but I had to go through there because I was traveling from Panama to the Ecuadorian Amazon. And so I spent 5 days going through there, and it ended up being the exact opposite of what everyone warned. The people were warm, hospitable, wonderful sense of humor. So by the time the country I was most wary of going to ended up being the most positive impression I gained from any country.
But you say there's a contrast there, the generosity of the regular Colombians and the greed of the officials.
Exactly. My first experience there, I did also get some insight into the negative side of Colombia. I had to pay a bribe to get my passport stamped. But that created curiosity about Colombia for me. And then when I went back in the 90s, got my university degree, decided I wanted to work in journalism. By the late 90s, it's when the U.S. was escalating its intervention in Colombia. And so I decided to go back to Colombia, and that's what I wanted to focus on.
Well, for Americans, I think Colombia brings up two images, cocaine and FARC. Now, the FARC, the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, is the largest guerrilla force there. But didn't it start as a peasant self-defense movement? And wasn't it associated with Colombia's Communist Party?
Yeah, the origins of the FARC lay in the violence from the 1950s. And at that time, the government was very repressive. The military was targeting rural peasant communities and displacing them. And some of these communities started forming armed self-defense groups, and they linked with the Communist Party, so they became ideologically communist. And eventually in 1964, they officially formed the FARC guerrilla movement as a communist or Marxist rebel movement.
Now, why were they being displaced? Why were the peasants being displaced? To make way for large landowners?
Well, a civil war broke out in 1948 that lasted for a decade and killed 200,000 Colombians. And it was basically the followers of the two prominent parties in Colombia, the conservatives and the liberals. Conservatives were in power, and they started massacring liberals, regions of the country where liberal peasants lived. Some of those regions also had more extremist or more leftist peasant groups who ended up breaking away from the liberals and joining the Communist Party, so they were also targeted.
In some parts of South America, in fact, Latin America, the wars are between people who mostly indigenous as opposed to people who come largely from the Spanish conquerors. Is that the case in Colombia as well?
Not so much in Colombia. Compared to its neighbors like Ecuador, Peru, Bolivia, Colombia has a very small indigenous population, only about 2-3% of the population. So most of the conflict in Colombia is between the Latino population. But having said that, the indigenous populations have been affected dramatically by the conflict as they try and maintain their traditional lifestyles in the countryside.
And try to not side with either side, but get caught in the middle?
Exactly. Many of the indigenous communities and Afro-Colombian communities have tried to stay neutral, but because they live on resource-rich lands, they've been disproportionately affected by the violence.
When did FARC become involved in cocaine?
It started in coca growers, the farmers that grow the coca plant, the leaves of which provide the raw ingredient for cocaine, has existed in Colombia from the 70s on a small scale. But in the 1990s, coca cultivation increased dramatically, and most of it was in the southern Colombia where the FARC dominate. And so they started taxing all the coca growers and the drug traffickers who operated in those regions, and that generated huge revenues for the FARC.
But what about their ideals? Did this compromise what they had started out to be all about?
Well, this is one of the kind of contradictions with the FARC is they are a political movement, ideological movement with political objectives, but at the same time, there's serious problems with them with regard to some of the human rights abuses they perpetrate, the fact that they profit from the drug trade, and among those human rights abuses, of course, is kidnapping to generate revenues as well.
And they kidnap wealthy landowners, tourists, government officials, all for the ransom money?
Well, there's two strategies there. One is wealthier Colombians, mainly middle and upper class Colombians or foreign business executives. They'll kidnap and hold for ransom for money. When they kidnap politicians, those are political bargaining chips, and they hold those in the jungle, and they hope to convince the government to negotiate a prisoner swap and release imprisoned guerrillas.
Well, their most famous captive in recent years was Ingrid Betancourt, but weren't you also captured by the FARC in August 2006?
Yeah, in 2006, I was traveling in a remote rural region to investigate the recent fumigations of coca crops in that region, and when I entered the region, the FARC guerrillas seized me, and they detained me on a farm for 11 hours while they determined what they should do with me.
So you were released a lot sooner than most of the people they kidnapped.
Yeah,
lots of they weren't asking for ransom in your case. They just simply were concerned that you were there to cause trouble for them?
Well, the reason I call it detained and not kidnapped is because I was held while they decided what to do with me. They could have evolved into a kidnapping. It was one of the options where they decided to hold me for ransom. But ultimately, they decided after 11 hours to let me do the work I was there to do. So they released me and gave me permission to work in the zone.
And is that because you've been pretty even-handed in your reporting? Were they even aware of that?
Well, I've interviewed and met with FARC before in different parts of the country, just not in that particular part. My guess is that they did research who I was and kind of work I did. And a lot of my writing with regard to U.S. drug policy in Colombia has been critical. And so in this instance, it served the FARC's interest, obviously, to let me investigate the fumigations.
My guest is Gary Leach. His book, Beyond Bogota, Diary of a Drug War Journalist in Colombia, published by Beacon. 30 journalists have been killed covering Colombia since 1995. You must have felt endangered at times.
Yes, at times. There's been certain times, certain places where I felt really threatened and wondered, you know, why am I doing this kind of work? But there's a certain immunity that foreign journalists have enjoyed. No foreign journalists have been killed. We've been detained. We've been threatened. But the more than 30 that have been killed are Colombian journalists. And I believe the reason is that Colombian journalists are affecting or influencing the opinions of the population that the armed groups are trying to control, whereas foreign journalists are writing for a foreign audience.
Well, hadn't you been made to sign a waiver upon entering Macarena National Park?
Yes, when I left the part of the country that was controlled by the government, the national police there insisted that I sign a waiver saying that they won't be held responsible if anything happens to me. And then once you cross that river, you basically entered another country, a FARC-controlled region.
That also does send a message to you. But this is not the first time for you, is it? Hadn't you been held in El Salvador back in the 1980s?
Yes, back in the 80s, when the early years of my introduction to Latin America, I was traveling through Central America, and in March 1982, I was crossing the border from Honduras into El Salvador, and the military there detained me at the border and accused me of being a mercenary for the guerrillas. At that time, I wasn't a journalist. I wasn't even understanding much of political issues in the region.
Well, El Salvador was a pretty scary country at the time, and yet you say that your capture by the FARC was more terrifying for you.
Yeah, even though I spent 8 days being interrogated and imprisoned in El Salvador, there was a couple of reasons why I didn't understand the political situation. I didn't understand that the military that was holding me was the worst human rights violator in El Salvador. I didn't realize the brutality they were capable of. And when I was being held in Colombia, I'm always more fearful because I understand the region a lot better. I understand the kind of atrocities that occur and what these groups are capable of. And I also involved because I write about what's going on in Colombia, and someone could be offended by what I write.
Do you speak Spanish with this accent that you have, that's kind of part British, part American, part Canadian?
Yeah, a lot of my Colombian friends joke about my Colombian accent because I'm the only one I know that speaks Colombian with a British-American accent.
Was your experience with the FARC would motivate you to write this book?
Yes. My previous books and all my articles had just been third-person accounts looking at the issues and analyzing the situation. But while I was being held captive by the FARC this time, I'd just become a father. I had a 3-month-old son. And all I could think about was, if something happens to me here, if I don't get out of here, he's not going to know why I do the work I do. And so that led me to write this first-person account, which initially wasn't intended to be a book. It was just to be a kind of memoir for him. But as it evolved, I thought, you know, maybe this could be a good book.
Well, much of it is about the United States' involvement in Colombia's drug wars. And we'll take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk about that. My guest is Gary Leach, who's written Beyond Bogota, Diary of a Drug War Journalist in Colombia, published by Beacon. We're back with Gary Leach, who is an independent journalist, editor of Columbia Journal, the author of Crude Interventions and Killing Peace, and co-author of The People Behind Colombian Coal. He's a lecturer in the Department of Political Science at Cape Breton University and the author of Beyond Bogota, Diary of a Drug War Journalist in Colombia, published by Beacon Press. We left off talking about the Colombian drug war. When did the U.S. get directly involved in it?
Well, they got involved in Colombia seriously in the early 80s, but that was targeting the trafficking cartels based in Medellin and Cali. The drug traffickers.
We pretty much broke up those major drug cartels, didn't we? Didn't that make a dent in the cocaine production?
Yeah, we actually, both of those have been dismantled by the mid-90s, but it didn't affect drug production or trafficking at all, as hundreds of micro-cartels replaced them, which actually made it harder to target them. But at the same time, in the 90s, as coca cultivation increased in the FARC's territories, the guerrilla force got stronger. It went from 3,500 fighters at the end of the 80s to about 18,000 by the end of the 90s. So the U.S. devised Plan Colombia to switch tactics away from the drug traffickers and focus on aerial fumigations of the coca crops. And that also happened to be in FARC-controlled territories, so it was a way to also insert counterinsurgency into the counter-narcotics operations.
Was that fumigation the way much of the money that the U.S. was sending to Colombia used? At one point, Colombia was the third largest recipient of U.S. military aid.
It still is. Ever since 2000, it's been the third largest recipient. It's getting over $500 million a year still as Plan Colombia continues. And most of that money, yeah, is for the fumigations. It's for helicopters. We provided them with over 60 Black Hawk and Huey helicopters. It also created a 3,000-man-strong army battalion. So it's 75% of Plan Colombia's aid, the $6 billion we've given since 2000, has been military aid, only about 25% for social and economic.
Well, who is actually suffering from this fumigation? The farmers are the people who make the least money in this whole chain.
Exactly. The farmers, coca is the only viable cash crop in many of these remote regions. There's no infrastructure. There's few roads, if any. They can't get perishable food crops to distant markets before the crops are spoiled. So it's the only viable cash crop because drug traffickers come and pick up the coca from them. And coca, they're not getting rich from it. As you said, they're still the poorest link in the chain. All it's done is lift them from maybe extreme poverty to poverty levels. But they're the principal targets of Plan Colombia.
Doesn't spraying coca plants also destroy other crops?
Exactly. The aerial fumigations are indiscriminate. And most coca growers, they have a few acres of land. 75% of it might be coca, but also around their houses are their subsistence food crops. But the planes come in, they spray not only the coca, all the food crops, they also spray the drinking water, the actual houses, and the people themselves.
Has the fumigation discouraged farmers from growing coca?
No, and this is the futility of attacking drugs at the source, because Plan Colombia, when it was initiated in 2000, the counter-narcotics objective was to reduce coca cultivation in Colombia by 50% in 5 years. We're now 8 years into Plan Colombia, more than $6 billion, and there is more coca being cultivated today than there was when we launched Plan Colombia.
And hasn't FARC actually gotten stronger during the same period?
They were in the initial part of Plan Colombia. They got stronger in the first few years, but in the last few years, they've been put on the defensive, because all the U.S. military aid, while it's failed miserably to reduce cocaine and coca and cocaine production, it has had some successes with regards to counterinsurgency. The Colombian military now has been strengthened to a point where it's pushed the FARC back to even more remote regions.
What about the right-wing paramilitaries? What role do they play in this conflict? Aren't they also financed by cocaine?
Yeah, they're actually more financed by cocaine than the FARC are. They are more directly linked to the drug trafficking, the processing of cocaine and trafficking of it out of Colombia to North America and Europe. They are right-wing death squads that were formed by the military, by rich landowners, and by the drug cartels to fight the guerrillas. They're fiercely anti-communist, and they work hand-in-glove with the Colombian military, which, of course, we're funding. But the thing they do is they don't just fight the guerrillas. They wage a dirty war against any members of the civilian population suspected to be guerrilla sympathizers, such as peasants in rural areas, or any people engaged in social change, such as unionists, human rights defenders, community organizers. Anyone that's critical of the government is automatically labeled a guerrilla or a terrorist in today's rhetoric, and targeted by the paramilitaries. And even the president, Uribe, repeatedly in public statements criticizes the human rights defenders and calls them guerrillas.
Now, what happened? Why did the war on drugs become the war on narco-terrorism? Was that something that happened after 9/11?
Yes, after 9/11, the rhetoric shifted to a war on terror, and Colombia became, the FARC actually became the principal non-Islamic group that was targeted by the Bush administration in the war on terror.
Why not the right-wing paramilitaries? You say that they are more involved in drug trafficking than FARC is.
Yeah, not only more involved in drug trafficking, but also responsible, even by the State Department's own figures, for the majority of the human rights abuses against the civilian population in Colombia. But the thing is that they're allied with the army we're funding in Colombia. And the FARC represents a challenge to U.S. Political and economic interests in the region.
So we're targeting FARC as much as we're really trying, intent on eradicating drugs.
Exactly. Because one of the economic components of Plan Colombia was to increase in mining and oil investment in Colombia. It's one of the top 12 suppliers of oil to the United States, and it's the number one foreign supplier of coal to the United States. It's a resource-rich region. So Plan Colombia, while it's failed to reduce cocaine production, it's increased security in these resource-rich rural regions, and that has resulted in a massive increase in foreign investment in Colombia.
Now, FARC is labeled a terrorist organization not just by the United States, but also the EU and Canada. So is this because the United States has requested that from the rest of the world, or is it because the rest of the world sees FARC as the major problem here?
I would say it's a bit of both. EU and Canada put FARC on the terrorist list after 9/11 under pressure of the U.S., the Bush administration, in its global war on terror. And Canada in particular didn't put the FARC on until April 2003. And many in Canada believe that that was a quid pro quo in return, because Canada refused to go along with the U.S. in Iraq. So therefore, okay, we'll do this for you.
Now, on the other hand, FARC has not helped itself by kidnapping people like Ingrid Betancourt and then holding her way past the time that anybody would have considered acceptable. They shouldn't have held her at all, but how many years?
6 years, I think she was in the jungle, yeah, held by the FARC.
And she was not alone.
No, politicians like her and soldiers and police, they had about 60 or 70 of them, and they've got several hundred civilians kidnapped for ransom. And there's no question that the FARC engages in terrorism. It targets the civilian population and kidnaps them. The only question that I have from my research in Colombia is the war on terror that we're waging in Colombia seems to be a selective war on terror, where we're, you know, fighting terrorism perpetrated by the Marxist guerrillas, but we're pretty much turning a blind eye to the terrorism by the right-wing paramilitaries.
And we are talking about a live war that involves gunfights, violence, landmines, and civilians caught in the middle?
Exactly. And this is the tragedy of Colombia's war. 95% of those killed are unarmed civilians. It's not the armed groups killing each other.
Do they tend to side with one group or the other?
Some do, but a lot just want to remain neutral. But they get accused of being sympathetic to one side or the other, and they get killed. And it's a humanitarian disaster as a result of the conflict. Colombia has the second largest internally displaced population in the world. Only the Sudan has more refugees. And Colombia has almost 4 million. It has, for the last 5 years in a row, it's had the largest number of landmine casualties in the world.
And we don't hear about that. We hear about landmine casualties in Asia, in Africa,
exactly.
But not in Colombia.
Exactly. And part of the problem with that is the way the media covers Colombia. The most of the violence and the conflict and the humanitarian crises are in the remote rural regions, which is where I work. And most of the foreign correspondents are based in Bogota, and they tend to reflect the official lines from there, and that's why the book's called Beyond Bogota. When I decided to work in Colombia, I decided I'm going to work in those regions where Plan Colombia is being implemented, where the war is taking place, and to get those perspectives and those stories that are being ignored.
My guest is Gary Leach. His book is Beyond Bogota, Diary of a Drug War Journalist in Colombia, published by Beacon Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. One of the things that I had not heard about, but you write about here, it's the 2002 massacre in the village of Bella Vista. What happened there?
Yes, this was a particularly tragic incident. It's in the poorest region of Colombia. Mostly Afro-Colombians live there. The only way to get there is by jungle river travel. And the FARC...
Afro-Colombians who had been brought in as slaves at one point?
Yeah, at one point, historically. Yeah, the descendants of slaves. And the FARC controlled this region back prior to 2002. The paramilitaries came downriver and decided they were going to take this town, Bella Vista, away from the FARC. So they arrived in the town. The FARC attacked the town to force the paramilitaries out. In the middle of the fighting, many of the residents went into the church to try and shelter themselves from the fighting. The paramilitaries set up their camp next to the church. The FARC then launched its homemade mortars, which are notoriously inaccurate, and it went right through the roof of the church, and it killed 119 people, nearly all women and children.
In June 2007, you interviewed Raul Reyes, the second-in-command of FARC, at a remote camp. How did he portray this conflict?
Well, he portrays it as an ideological struggle that basically Colombia historically has been ruled by a small group of elites. As a result of that, there's gross inequalities, and that is true. Colombia is one of the most unequal countries in the world regarding wealth distribution. And this ruling elite has long run the country. It's repressed the population, and the U.S. has traditionally supported it. And so what they're struggling for is to overthrow the government, implement a socialist system, and redistribution of the wealth and all of that. But yeah, when I asked him about the human rights abuses and stuff like that, you know, they don't really have any solid justifications for why, you know, they carry those out. They use a class struggle argument. You know, the middle and upper classes benefit and support the system, so we kidnap them because to gain war taxes.
And that old argument, you have to break a couple of eggs to make an omelet.
Yeah, and that's pretty much their approach.
But they have suffered a lot recently. In 2008, the Colombian army seemed to make several important gains, including the release of Ingrid Betancourt and the killing of some of FARC's leaders, including Raul Reyes. So is this effort being seeing some success?
Yeah,
has it weakened FARC?
Yes, yeah, it's weakened them. 8 months after I visited Reyes, I spent 3 days in his camp, is when an airstrike killed him and 19 other guerrillas. And that represented the first time that the Colombian government has killed or captured any of the FARC's seven-member secretariat. The FARC And this is why I was saying Plan Colombia, it's failed miserably as a counter-narcotics initiative, but it's had some success, a lot of success, as a counter-insurgency initiative. The U.S. technology, intelligence gathering, plus the improved training and fighting capacity of the Colombian military has really pushed the FARC back on the defensive. 10 years ago, the FARC controlled about 40% of the national territory. Now it's probably about 20%.
A month ago, today I think it is, President Bush awarded the Presidential Medal of Freedom to President Alvaro Uribe. The White House said that he was cited for his efforts to promote democracy, human rights, and peace abroad.
Yeah, there's a lot of contradiction about concern about that award, because there's a lot of people in Colombia and groups here who are opposed to Uribe's policies because there's a lot of repression. The state now, the Colombian military, has now replaced the paramilitaries as the leading human rights abuser in the country. And what you have now is two Colombias. In the urban areas, in the center of the country, you've got a prosperous, booming economy and much more security. But in the rural regions, it's just as much conflict. In some places, it's worse. The poverty is the same. And still, anybody who criticizes the government becomes a target.
Now, why do you think that coverage of all of this has been so unbalanced by outside journalists? After all, we see different approaches in other countries where there are similar inequities.
Yeah, I think part of it is the culture of the way the mainstream media works, like the correspondents for the big dailies in the U.S. and the wire services. They've all got full-time correspondents in Colombia, in the capital of Bogota. And the way I've seen them work is basically they rely on official sources, you know, whoever they can get, the highest official they can get interviews with or quotes from. And they spend very little time out in the rural regions where I work. So their coverage overwhelmingly reflects the official views of the Colombian government and the U.S. embassy, which why we have such a favorable presentation of Uribe, which is somewhat accurate, but a total omission of all the human rights issues around.
We got a comment on our show page from Carlos in New Jersey. He says, while you're obviously familiar with Colombia, he finds you very biased. Could you explain what happened when 11 senators were killed by the FARC? Also ask about the 27
indigenous
Awau Indians who were killed south of Cali.
Yeah, and it's an interesting comment, and I get this a lot. And what it is I'm not sympathetic to the FARC at all, and as I've pointed out several times here, they are responsible for a lot of human rights abuses. But what the common reaction is if you criticize the government, you criticize U.S. aid, then you're automatically assumed to be sympathetic to the guerrillas. And this is part of the problem in Colombia, and this is the justification for the dirty war. If you criticize the government, you must be sympathetic to the guerrillas.
You're saying that this is a very complicated situation. There are any number of forces that are culpable in one way or another, and there's no way to sort out the good guys from the bad guys.
It's very complex, and you know, there's a lot of people in Colombia who are critical of the government, who are on the left politically, who are working nonviolently. And just because you're critical of the government and its policies in the U.S. does not mean you're a guerrilla or sympathetic to them, but you get labeled as such.
Do you think that it is possible for the United States to win this war on drugs?
I don't think it's possible to win it militarily as they're trying to do. And I think Plan Colombia proves that. You know, 8 years, over $6 billion, and coca cultivation has increased in Colombia. I mean, this is failing miserably. And yet we keep throwing over $500 million of taxpayer money into this initiative.
What about Europe? Some of this cocaine also makes its way to Europe, doesn't it? Aren't they just as concerned as the U.S. is?
Yes, they are. And they haven't got as engaged in Colombia, but to the degree that they have, they've taken a very different approach. What they've chosen to do is fund social and economic initiatives at the community level in different parts of rural Colombia and try and create viable economic alternatives for Colombian farmers and peasants. And they've never supported Plan Colombia, and they've never participated in it, even though the Clinton administration originally wanted them. And so they've taken a social solution. They don't think there's a military solution to the drug problem.
Gary Leach is spelt with two R's in the first name, two E's in the second. His book, Beyond Bogota, Diary of a Drug War Journalist in Colombia, is published by Beacon Press. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Leonard.